Approximately 60 years ago, when my grandfather died, my mother suggested that I kiss my grandfather, and if I kissed him, I'd never be afraid of the dead. And I did, and I've never been afraid of the dead.
Padre nuestro que está en el cielo, oh santo sea tu nombre, mi Dios celestial.
The following program, Let's Talk About Death and Bereavement, is a co-production between Ger Cunahan, Kayla Jackson, and Carmel Fitzpatrick, 103.2. Dublin City FM. This program will discuss the cultural impact of death and bereavement and how different cultures and people of different faith deal with this time in their lives. The first person we spoke to was Peter Murta, and Peter has just returned from the Philippines, where he has experienced death on a massive scale. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
Peter, just because you're just back from the Philippines, and the program is called Let's Talk About Death and Bereavement. Personally, how do you think the people of the Philippines, how does one cope with such mass destruction that you have no control over, as opposed to a good death in your own home or in a bed surrounded by your loved ones?
I suppose the simple answer is I don't know. When you see, as I did only about 8 or 10 days ago, the scale of destruction and death out there, it's very hard to know how do people cope with it.
Peter goes on to explain how he was invited by a local Catholic priest to witness a mass burial.
And he mentioned, by the by, that there were some funeral rites later that morning up at a cemetery just north of the city, North Tacloban Municipal Cemetery. So I thought, I'll go to that and I will sort of, I suppose, soak up, go back to your question, how this community is dealing with bereavement. And it was harrowing, and it was awful in many ways. It was a mass grave. A JCB had dug a pit about 100 metres long by about 6 or 8 feet wide. There were about 400 bodies in it already, in body bags, and 200 more were being placed in that morning. And the priest, he came and he stood in the middle of the road in the rain at times as the body bags were loaded off a dumper truck and carried one by one by firefighters and police officers and placed into the mass grave. And as each one passed, he said a few words. And I think what was so sad about it, apart from the obvious, a mass grave unmarked, was that there were no relatives there because people didn't know. Because the bodies aren't identified. Yeah, what the authorities were doing was marking each body bag with an indication as to where it was found. So if I can translate into the Dublin context, if the body was found in Sandymount, for instance, it was marked D4.
Okay.
And perhaps there might have been a little bit more specific. It might have been D4A, if such a place could be identified.
Yes.
And that was it. As to how the people are coping, I think faith is important to them. It's quite visible. I think, like a lot of poor people the world over, faith and a belief in something beyond themselves, something that gives them hope for a better life, I think that's important to them. It seemed to me it was important to them. The human species does seem to have a need to believe in some extra power beyond itself. It calls for a huge amount of faith, and also I think, kind of moving away from the faith side of things, although I think it's related to it, they did seem, in the face of this appalling disaster, they did seem to have a part of their national character, if you like, was a certain resilience, a certain stoicism, a certain this is what happens from time to time, and without diminishing it in any way, this is what happens from time to time, and we make the best of it, and we get on with it.
And that was Peter Murta, Irish Times journalist, reflecting not only on death, but on the massive scale of death that occurred in the Philippines as a result of a deadly typhoon. Death in all its brutality, followed by faith, resilience and acceptance.
I have a prayer inside of me. Imagine.
What is humanism? Humanism can be defined as a rationalist outlook or system of thought attaching prime importance to human rather than divine or supernatural matters. To enlighten us on humanism and on a humanist approach to death and bereavement, we invited humanist Hugh Hick into the studio. The first question Carmel Fitzpatrick asked Hugh was for his definition of the truth of death.
I suppose I'd say that the truth of death is that death is the truth. It's the one thing that no matter what walk of life we take in life, it's the one inevitability that we all face. And I feel it always shapes us as people. Some people want to be good people because they believe that they'll be rewarded after death for that goodness. But even if you believe that or you don't believe that, the idea that there is a finite amount of time in this world and that there is eventually going to be that cessation of life, that drives people. It's what makes people who they are. And I suppose coming from a perspective of someone who believes that death is the end, I find I've got a fairly unique view on that. I suppose I believe my philosophy to death would be, you know that quote, I'm not sure who said it, might have been Gandhi, who said that a person dies two deaths, first when their body is put in the ground and second when the last person ever mentions their name. And I suppose that's roughly my view of death, you know.
So you have quite a strong consciousness of death in your everyday existence. Where did that start?
I suppose you always get that sense when you see someone die. It makes you think, and I suppose I've faced death a couple of times in my life. My father died when I was around 16, and a very formative time in my life. You're a teenager, you're kind of getting to grips as to who you are as a person, and for death to be such a big and sudden thing in that, you're inevitably going to look to yourself and your own attitudes to death and think, what exactly does death mean to me?
Seasons don't fear the reaper. When the sun and the rain, we can be like they are. Come on, baby, feel the reaper. Baby, take my hand, feel the reaper. We'll be able to fly.
And now let's go back to Carmel and Hugh Hick.
Now, have you been at funerals of other denominations and seen the rituals and practices, and did they strike you in any particular way?
I suppose I've been to a few. I was raised in the Protestant denomination, so I would have gone to a couple of them as a child, Catholic as well. I suppose the most interesting funeral ritual I've ever been to, and I'm not entirely sure what the denomination was, but a friend of mine who unfortunately died of leukemia several years ago, she was brought into the church carried by Vikings in a coffin. And it was requested at the funeral that no one wear the usual black and white suit. They wear something colourful because she was quite an out there person in the most fantastic way. Mm. And she knew that this death was coming, and her request was that at her funeral, it wasn't a morbid occasion. It was a celebration of her life and the lives of people she cared about and the fact that they'd be going on into the future and, I suppose, carrying her memory with them.
And now, have you thought about what way you might like your funeral to go? Or is that asking a question too far?
I like that story there of the celebration of the life. I kind of like that. And I like the idea that people might bring, I suppose, poetry and song and art into it, because those are things that have always been very important in my life. And I always believe, you know, these occasions should be a celebration of the values that were important to that person.
We now turn to the Buddhist perspective on death and bereavement. Carmel Fitzpatrick speaks to Nyanadhara from the Dublin Buddhist Centre, who will focus on the fact that, according to Buddhism, the best preparation for death is to live well. Buddhists believe that when your physical body dies, you go on to seek rebirth in a new life. And once again, this new life will depend on how you have lived your current physical life. Another two interesting aspects of Buddhist belief is that Buddhism encourages people to resolve, for example, a quarrel, some pending issue that you have before you die. And also, they tend to share the process of dying. That is, for example, if one member is dying of an incurable illness, he or she might be asked to talk to other practicing Buddhists about the dying process. Here now is Carmel Fitzpatrick talking to Nyanadhara.
Nyanadhara is the Dharmachari in the Dublin Buddhist Centre, and he's here to talk to me about the subject of death. Now, can you tell us first off, what are the Buddhist beliefs about death?
So the general Buddhist belief is that when the body dissolves, you know, at death, the senses stop working and the physical body dies, there's a continuum of consciousness or mind. And after death, that will seek, as we say, rebirth in a new life. And that new life will arise according to how the person has lived their previous life.
How do you encourage people to prepare for death in the course of their life?
Well, the main thing, really, from a Buddhist perspective, is the best preparation for death is to live well. You know, to live a life of kindness, sensitivity to others, intelligence, wisdom, and so on. And if you cultivate those qualities, that's the best preparation you can make for dying. I mean, actually, one other thing I could say is that the Buddha also explicitly encourages his followers to resolve quarrels. So if you know there's a quarrel that you have with a person in your family or a friend, that it's really important to resolve that if you can while the person is still alive. The other thing actually is to, in terms of preparation for death, is to just share in the process. So if people around you are dying, or if you are dying, just in a way sort of share the process so other people can experience that and in a way prepare for their own death by sharing in the process of your own death. So that's something we would do in our tradition, that people, if they are dying, like, for example, there's a man who was dying of terminal cancer recently in our order, and he just spoke at a large meeting just about the experience of, you know, having terminal cancer and what that was like for him, which a lot of people found extremely moving.
And that was Nyanadhara, a practicing Buddhist from the Dublin Buddhist Centre. As Hinduism appears to be a complex religion and is the third largest world religion after Christianity and Islam, I travelled out to Lucan and met Dr. Hemant Kumar in the Hindu Cultural Centre of Ireland. Dr. Hemant Kumar, you practice the Hindu religion.
It's not in fact a religion, it's more of a way of life than of a religion, because we have no competition with anyone when it comes to religion. People try to compete, try to convert, and there's no conversion in Hinduism. And the aim of life is to achieve the salvation or moksha, or you can say liberation of desires. One can achieve in any of the places by having some very simple few aims and objectives.
This strikes me as a very explicit definition of life. That is, that the aim of life is to achieve the liberation of desires. That's the Hindu take on life. Now, let's see what the Hindu take on death is.
First thing we believe in, that in the whole world, in the whole creation, we have three things in existence. One is soul, one is super soul, and one is a nature. Super soul is a God, which anyone can achieve through any way. That's not a problem. And then the soul. Soul is energy, what we all have in us. Energy in us is a soul. And the body is a part of nature, and the other things which we see around is also a part of nature. When we become soul conscious that we are not a body, the problem comes that we distinguish ourselves, we make ourselves as a body. And when we think that we are body, then we become, then amnesia comes to us, that we forget that we are a soul. And main soul is, qualities of soul is peace, happiness, love. When we forget ourselves and we become a body, which is given by the different labels are given to that body, like I am a doctor, or I am a father, I am a husband, I am a teacher. So they all are the other labels which are given to this body. So when we become body consciousness, then we become more of, we go to the negative attitude of ego, anger, competition, jealousy. These things come into the mind. And soul, according to Vedas and according to Gita, never dies. Soul is eternal. Body is a part of nature that dies.
If you believe in Hinduism, you believe that all that is dying is your natural body. Dr. Kumar, it's going to be hard to convince me to believe, if you like, the Hindu way.
Well, that's fine. Everybody has his own belief system. And these beliefs, and everybody is right. These belief systems have come to us, to our mind, because of our birth, because of our family, because of our teachings, because of our environment, because of our friends, because of our studies. So we have our own belief system, that's fine. But again, if somebody believes it, there's no harm in believing it, and he is believing it. But again, he's in trouble as well because of that believing, because he's always in fear of death. So the main aim of this Vedic teachings, that soul cannot die, soul will always remain, it is eternal.
Dr. Kumar accepts that people differ with regard to religion, beliefs, and perspectives on life and death. But he does insert a proviso that lack of belief in soul makes it more likely that a person will fear death. This actually ties in very much with Father Peter McVerry. I travelled down to Sherard Street to meet Father Peter McVerry and to gain an insight into the perspective of a Catholic priest on death and bereavement.
Well, for me as a Christian, we are not just blood and bones and sinews, that while we all share the same physical characteristics, there is a personality in each person which is quite different from one person to another, and that we try and put a name on it, we call it soul. So there's something within each one of us that's more than just the body we're in. Our belief is that that person continues to live even after death. So for me, death is a sadness at the departure of someone, but also a celebration of their life and a celebration and faith in their continued life, in eternal life.
I'm afraid of death. Is that normal?
I think if most people are afraid of death. I don't see the point of being afraid of death myself. There are only two options. If you're a believer, then after you die, you continue to live on in God, in eternal happiness. If you're an atheist, then there's nothing after death. And so you simply fall asleep and don't wake up. In either case, what's there to be afraid of? So I personally don't fear death. A lot of people do fear death, but I don't rationally understand why they fear death. I think in the past, death was much more part of life. People were waked at home over a period of time. Today we have hidden death away. When somebody dies, we bring them down to a funeral home. We bring them to the church. And death is something we try to not experience as part of normal life. And I think that creates then this sense of fear of death. But in the past, where in communities where people died, there was no funeral home, they just were waked back at home, and everybody came, and they were around maybe for several days, they were waked, and then all the neighbours were around and all the family were around, and death was just a normal part of community life. And I think that helps to take away some of the fear of death. But today we've gone in the other opposite direction. We've tried to hide death away, pretend in some way that it's not a reality for us. And I think that helps to contribute to the fear factor that people experience. So for me, death is both an enormous sadness, but also a celebration of their life and a celebration of my faith in eternal life.
Father McVerry pointed out also, paraphrasing somewhat, how the loss of ritual in Ireland, in the case of Ireland, how the loss of ritual may have hidden in some way the reality of death, thereby increasing the fear of death. I'd go on to expand on that and even say that death in Ireland and in rich countries is, inverted commas, not normal. It's not a normal event. For example, the average life expectancy in Ireland as we speak is 80 years of age approximately, whereas in the 1940s for men it was under 60. And shockingly, a CSO study has found that the death rate for children aged between 0 and 4 was 1,511 per 100,000. That's for males. And that was in 1949. In 1998, the same figure was 177. So compare 1,511 to 177. Without being flippant, I'm tempted to say that with so much death around, it seemed more normal. Death seemed more accepted as a natural event. Whereas nowadays, maybe with medical progress and expectations and high expectations, we expect to live longer. And in some way, we have distanced ourselves from death. The lack of ritual surrounding the death of a person is very apparent in the practices of the Unitarian Church. To enlighten us on Unitarianism, Carmel Fitzpatrick spoke to Reverend Bridget Spain.
Now, can you talk to me a little bit, please, about what Unitarians believe about God in the first place?
Carmel, we don't have any set dogma about God. Unitarianism grew out of the Reformation. People were of the opinion that the Reformation wasn't radical enough because the Reformation retained creeds and hierarchy. And Unitarians were firmly of the belief that no one else had the right to tell anyone else what they should believe about God. And that has remained constant in the church. So we don't have any dogma about what to believe about God. People find their own spiritual path.
Now, what is the place of death in the Unitarian faith?
Oh, everybody marks death. People of all faiths and none. They all mark death. You don't really have a choice, do you?
No.
You don't have a choice about encountering death. How you mark it can be very different. And we don't have a set funeral service that people go by. If somebody comes to us with looking for a funeral, we will sit down and ask them and talk to them and ask them what the person who has died wanted and what they want from the funeral service. And together we will put a service together that marks the life of the deceased person and hopefully helps the people who are attending the funeral service.
And what about people who we'll call them of the Unitarian faith who are dying? How do you support them? Do you support them with prayers or do you support them in accordance with their own beliefs about what God is and what the afterlife is?
We would support them in terms of their own beliefs. Now, we would probably pray for them privately, but we would tend not to say formal prayers. If I heard a member of the congregation wasn't well, we would probably remember them at the beginning of our service. We begin by lighting a candle, and I would say, you know, as we light a candle, we would pray for Joe or Mary or remember them because they're not well.
You were talking about the funeral service as something that's not specifically laid out in terms of a Unitarian rite. I presume the same is the case with the process of mourning, that it's a less formalised way of supporting someone who's actually mourning.
Absolutely, much less formalised. And that has its downsides, you know. I think that one of the things today is that when we hear that someone we know has been bereaved, we will go and attend the funeral service and we might send them flowers or a card or something like that. But then we really want them to get back to business more or less straight away. Whereas traditional things like month, mind, mass are markers, you know. The old idea of when people wore a black band or, you know, a symbol of grief. They were given the leeway for about a year.
So we can ask ourselves the question here, does a longer mourning period help the bereaved overcome the loss, or does a shorter mourning period help people to get back to their routine, to business, to their normal life as quickly as possible? Now, Kayla Jackson speaks to the Dean of Christ Church, Dermot Patrick Martin Dunn. As you will hear almost immediately in his contribution, the Dean has experienced a very close encounter with death.
The concept of the program is to discuss the cultural impact of death and bereavement. And if people find their comfort in their from their culture, or if they find their comfort from their faith. And Dermot, do you have many brothers and sisters?
I have, alive now, I have three brothers and three sisters. I have one sister who died quite young.
So your mother, you had a large family?
Yes, and I came in the middle.
And how did your sister's death, your sister's passing have any effect? Well, not any effect, but what kind of effect did your sister passing have on you?
My sister died by suicide. So it was quite a traumatic effect. And she died at the age of 35. I was in priesthood at the time. We were the closest in the family. And I felt part of me died with her. And it's such a tragedy because we didn't, like all suicides, no one knew or could see that there was a pathway going to it. So that tragedy really hit hard and asked the questions about the meaning of life and death and where God is in all this. And as every death does that is close to us, these questions and the question of our own death as well.
I think suicide is a particularly, it must have been very difficult for your mother and father and for your siblings and for you to deal with.
It was quite a difficulty because we're a very close family. And the question is, we weren't there for her, or were we there for her? All those questions,
the blame and the guilt
and all that came in, which is very human.
Very human.
And especially with someone who's very close and saying, we should have known. And all these questions, and you know that these are the questions that everyone that has experienced suicide in their family or close friends.
And was that a long time ago, Dermot?
It's now about 13 years ago.
You never get over anything like that, do you?
What I always say about grief and death is that you never forget. You learn to live with it. It becomes part of your life. That loss becomes part of your everyday living. That is not a depressing thing. It's quite an energetic and living because the people are still living in your heart.
Do you think that in grief, that's one of the things that can help you if you have the strength to keep them in your heart and not put it to one side and say, OK, you know, I have to get over this. I have to get on with my life.
That is absolutely true, because grief is a process, as you know. And I think our human psychic and the way we're built is that grief is very much part of our lives to help us to integrate death into our living. And we can't just shove it away. As painful and all as it is, we need to go through the pain to be able to assimilate it in our lives. And it's given to us. It's a tool for us to enable us to live and to process the grief and the death of someone very close to us.
Very profound, very touching words from the Dean of Christ Church. What struck me thus far in his contribution is the fact that he believes deeply in the grieving process. And paraphrasing, he says that grief and pain are tools to enable us to live, that enable us to understand death. And perhaps another uplifting aspect of his perspective on life and death is that he believes that the people who are dead are still living in your heart. The Dean of Christ Church, Dermot Patrick Martin Dunn, touches on the role of the community and the importance of the community in handling grief and death.
And I think one of the advantages of Irish culture is that we still have a good, decent community aspect to it. And community is all important in times of grief. Being able to talk to other people knowing what you're going through, being able to say a kind word, an odd word here or an odd word there. Not so much sympathy, but empathy.
About
saying, I'm with you. I know, I feel your pain and I can't take it away, but just lean on me.
Exactly.
Things like that are all helpful.
And finally, we hear from the very Reverend Dermot Dunn, Dean of Christ Church. We hear about the story of death he recently encountered firsthand when he spent some time with a dying mother of two, a young mother who had a different perspective on the word fear of death.
Recently, I experienced the death of a 34-year-old woman whose Hester was her name, married to my nephew. Very tragic. And I had the privilege of talking to her for an hour, a few days before she died. And she was a woman who never had any religion or faith, but I think had a real deep inner spirituality. And I talked to her about her spirituality, which she found in nature. She studied in human zoology, or sorry, animal husbandry and zoology, and all that was animating her spirituality. But I remember saying to her, "My prayer for you as you're dying is that you can let go of fear and let go into peace." And her response to that, and she's the mother of two children, she said, "My prayer would be different. My fear is keeping me alive." And she was using it as a tool to keep her alive. Wow. So that she could get the last out of her time for here her children here on earth. And it wasn't, I thought it was quite philosophical.
Yes,
and
it is.
It wasn't a terror.
Okay, there's a difference.
There's a huge difference.
Okay, so it was a healthy fear that she had.
Yes.
And she was, that's a lovely way of saying it, isn't it?
Yes.
Using your fear to keep you alive so you can get the last drop out of life.
It was a real learning point for me. I came away with a gift.
And that was the Reverend Dermot Dunn, Dean of Christ Church. We now head down to County Carlow, Carlow College to be precise, where we talk to Doctor in Philosophy, Noel Kavanagh. Noel begins by emphasising the fact that we are aware that our existence on this earth has a finite term, which in turn dictates our behaviour and the way we act, and indeed affects the nature of our project that we undertake in life. As an aside, I could say that knowing you have only a short natural life on this earth may help to focus the mind and the body. Noel will also touch upon the subject of euthanasia. As a philosopher, do you have a personal view on death, or, and can you also give me a philosophical view on same?
Well, yes, I have a personal view on death. For me, it would come largely from the existentialist position of facing up to the fact of death. And when one realizes, as Heidegger, the German philosopher, said, that one is a being toward death. When one realizes that you have to decide this side of death as to what's the far side of death, that fundamentally then motivates your life project, you know. And that can get revealed in everyday language of kind of, you know, we're here for a short time, not a long time, and make the most out of life. All of those kind of, anecdotal kind of folk philosophies that we express are an expression of the fact that when we realise that we are going to die, that the more we do that, the more it informs how we live the life we have. Now, that brings us to the idea, therefore, of whether that death that we live through, ironically speaking, is part and parcel of that life project.
This may be a pertinent question, especially for those of you and those of us who lived through the 40s, 50s and 60s in Ireland. And that is, does death and the fear of, if you like, chastisement afterwards, if we don't behave well, so to speak, does this shape the way we live our life before death and up to death? In a way, Hinduism and Buddhism suggest this partly, in that if you live a good life, you will go on to a better life. For Catholics in Ireland, the question could be, do I believe that by behaving well, that by living a good life, whatever that means, that this will guarantee me a better afterlife experience, a better after-death experience? How many in Ireland now believe that? How many in Ireland, we could ask, have the comfort of that thought, of that belief?
That brings up very, very difficult questions about, as we come towards death, how that is approached for us. The term euthanasia, which we get into a dreadful moral panic about an awful lot of the times, simply in Greek, euthanasia means dying well. And once one has one's understanding of one how to lead one's life, one ought to be able to die in that way. So that brings up very, very obviously contentious issues in terms of coming towards death, of how we treat that death, how we perhaps even facilitate or ought to facilitate that death.
For some, dying well might mean dying in the belief of the afterlife, dying in the belief that one's soul is perpetual, that one has done one's best in life, and there will be many who will question our right or anybody's right to prematurely end the life of somebody else. We leave philosopher Dr. Noel Kavanagh from Carlow College, and we turn now to the Jewish tradition. Carmel Fitzpatrick speaks to Rabbi Lent. The rabbi will outline how this particular world we live in at the moment is just a brief moment in time and is in fact a preparation for the real world, which is the afterlife, according to Jewish tradition. He will also speak about how Jewish people prepare for death and the rituals surrounding same.
What are Jewish beliefs about death and the afterlife?
Okay, well, basically the idea is that there are two worlds, and this world is really just the entrance way, like the porch into the main hall. So, you know, whether we live for 60, 70, 80, 90 years, it's actually only a very brief moment of time. It's a preparation for what we see as the real world, which is the world to come.
So now, how does a person of the Jewish faith prepare for death? And what are the type of supports offered by the clergy to the dying?
Well, the preparations would be, I suppose, similar to many faiths, in that you just really want to kind of tie up any loose ends before you pass away. You want to have, you know, asked forgiveness from anyone that you may have upset or hurt. You want to kind of, you know, straighten out any financial transactions. You want to have spoken to all your children and relatives and told them anything that you want to share with them before you go. So that would be interpersonal. And then in terms of faith, you kind of want to make sure that when you do go to the next world, you've done the very best you can to fix up for any kind of failings that you've had. So the Hebrew word for that is teshuvah, which is repentance or return. So it would be important to ask forgiveness from God for any kind of anything we may have done wrong or any sins committed while we were alive.
And then closer to the time of death, are there any prayers offered for the person, or do you perform any ceremonies over them?
You know, once the person is quite sick, you know, often there'll be a call out for a pastoral visit from the rabbi. And there are various prayers that are said when the person is quite sick, and there are also prayers that we say in the synagogue, you know, for a recovery for the person. So often at the bedside we'll say the Shema prayer, the most famous prayer in the Jewish faith, which is the Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And there's also a prayer in Hebrew, it's called Adon Olam, and the last sentence of that is we say b'yad chaf kid ruchi, that we entrust our soul over to you, over to God, and that's a kind of comforting thing. So, and then the very final prayer that's said when a person feels that, you know, this is their final few moments, there is an atonement prayer where they would ask forgiveness for any sins committed, and so that when the time comes to leave this world, they do it with a clear conscience.
Now, what about the funeral rites for the family and then for the wider community?
So the Jewish custom is there's no wake, there's no viewing of the body. Once the person has passed away, the body's covered, and from that point, there's no, you know, like the family doesn't see the deceased. There's no preparation of the body for people to see. Every Jewish community has an amazing small group of people that we call it the Holy Burial Society in Hebrew. That's Chevra Kadisha, and this burial society, they're all volunteers. There's no payment involved, and they're all, you know, that they may be professionals, they may be retired, they may be students, and they, when they hear someone has passed away, they'll drop everything, they'll leave the office, and they'll go and pick up the body and make sure that it's treated respectfully and discreetly and prepared for the burial. And Jewish tradition, the preparation for burial entails cleaning and washing the body, like a purification process with water, and then the body's clothed in white shrouds, white clothing, and the coffin, which is an interesting custom, is that the coffin is identical for everyone. So it doesn't matter whether the person was incredibly wealthy and powerful or just a simple homeless person on the street. Everyone gets the same simple pine coffin. Which is, you know, different than many other traditions.
And then in terms of burial, am I right in thinking there is, and this may be from a tradition, from something I saw myself, that as the coffin is carried to the graveyard, sometimes it's turned around in order for maybe the head to be towards the grave or the feet to be towards home. Am I right or wrong about that?
Yeah, well, the tradition is that it's feet first whenever you're dealing with a deceased person. So it's always moved. The feet are always first. So that's why sometimes they would turn the coffin.
Is there a specific time during which it's considered appropriate to mourn, and are there specific rites around mourning, religious rites around mourning?
Yes, and the big difference would be whether it's for parents or for a spouse or a sibling, let's say. So. There is an initial first week of mourning, which is called Shiva, which just means seven, and it's a seven-day period after the funeral when those that are mourning for the deceased will stay in their home. They don't leave the home for the week. They sit on a kind of uncomfortable situation where they sit on a very low stool. They're not wearing leather shoes. They're not shaving or bathing. There's actually a process called kriya, which is the tearing of the garment close to the heart. And that situation takes place for a week. And that's actually an amazing kind of healing process, because while you're at home during that week of Shiva, that's the time that all of your friends and family and relatives all come and visit. They know you're going to be at home for the week. They know that there'll be prayers in the home. And they have an opportunity to come over to the house and spend that time talking to you, comforting, maybe sharing memories and stories of the deceased. So it's actually the most wonderful experience. And if you talk to people that have been through the Shiva process, they find it incredibly healing that, you know, instead of going back to work the next day and kind of bottling up some of those feelings, there's a whole week where you have to sit and just, you know, focus on the memory of the person that's passed away. Of course, when you have this concept that you're going into another world and you're going to have, there'll be a judgment and you'll be rewarded for the good things, that's also very comforting, that it's not the end, that there will be some kind of connection from that world with the family that you leave behind.
Rabbi Lent of the Jewish tradition, which believes, among other things, that there will be a judgment, you will be rewarded according to your actions, and more importantly for him, death is not the end. The word hospice stems from the Latin word hospitium, meaning guest house. It was originally used to describe a place of shelter for weary and sick travellers returning from religious pilgrimages. During the 1960s, the modern hospice movement began with St. Christopher's Hospice near London. St. Christopher's organised a team approach to professional caregiving and was the first programme to use modern pain management techniques to compassionately care for the dying. The Laura Lynn House on Leopardstown Road is Ireland's children's hospice, and it supports children with life-limiting conditions and their families by providing high-quality transitional care, home support, respite, crisis and end-of-life care. Myself and Carmel Fitzpatrick travelled out to the Laura Lynn House, where we met the chaplain, Thomas Begley, and the clinical psychologist, Dr. Aidan McKiernan. So I'm talking to Thomas Begley and Dr. Aidan McKiernan. Thomas, can you explain what you do and something about the centre, please?
Well, I'm the chaplain here at Laura Lynn. I'm the chaplain since about 2005. Laura Lynn was set up in September 2011, really for to outreach and to kind of support children who had end-of-life care needs as a respite service and a kind of a home-from-home service for children and families of that of that type.
In general, do Irish people or did Irish people have a problem when the subject, if you like, in conversation, the subject of death came up?
Well, especially death and children would be a huge no-no, I'd say, and a hugely difficult subject for parents and families and our culture to talk about or to be at ease in talking about. So it's something that, you know, I suppose the work of Laurel Lynn is part of it, would be, like we said, to educate the public in what we do and actually how we do it, and to try to begin and start the conversation of death and dying and children and families and all that that entails.
So it's not, Dr. Aidan McKiernan, it's not a taboo subject?
I think it is a taboo subject. Death and dying is something that people often prefer not to focus on. It's the one surety in life, that we will all become ill and that we will all die. But when you add in the idea that a young person or a child might die, well, that's very often something that's very hard for people to comprehend. As an employee of Laurel Lynn, certainly personally, I find when I explain to people where I work that it gets a certain kind of a response, and people comment that it's probably a very heavy role to have. So there tends to be some consistency in people's attitudes towards this. There's a very important book called the Tibetan Book of Death and Dying, and there's an idea in that that perhaps there's something very important about us turning towards this, and that there's something very life-affirming, paradoxically, in talking and coming to terms with this.
Okay. That's something I want to ask you. It's kind of a personal question for both of you. You're here to help the children and help the bereaved, but how do you console yourselves when you lose a child? When you are in the throes of it with the parent, is there a degree of, you know, you have your professional capacity, but there must be some sense of shared humanity dealing with something that's shared?
There is a very fine line. And it's difficult, and it's not something that I think you learn or you can put a procedure in place to guard against. I think each professional will, in their career at various times, depending on what's happening with them and their relationship with the child and family here, find that it may be more difficult to negotiate certain experiences that we have here and certain losses. There is certainly something very important about understanding your professional role and the importance of boundaries in order for us to sustain ourselves. But, yeah, you get touched by what happens here. This is very powerful experiences that people are having here.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I was going to say, Thomas, too, yeah. We do have staff here who are parents themselves and have children, obviously, and that can be difficult for them, too, you see, because they have kids themselves. They might have a 2 or 3 year old. We have children here who have died at that age. So it touches, you have obviously kind of parallels and people being saying, well, I have a child at that age and like it could be me. And yet it's not me, it's somebody else. So there are a lot of kind of parallels and challenges there for our staff who are kind of fathers and mothers themselves and who have children and who luckily sort of enjoy good health. And I think that can be a very kind of challenging scenario for many of our staff.
Well, maybe just add that I think that in medical context and in a hospice setting, things have become more sanitised than they were now. And so there isn't maybe always that kind of very real contact with the more visceral side of it. But I think what has improved is that we are maybe communicating more sensitively around these things. So there was a kind of matter-of-fact maybe way of speaking before. I think too that certainly in my own personal life I would have people who would have reflected on their own experiences from decades ago of having lost a baby and would have found it very difficult when people would have made statements along the lines of, well, you know, don't let that get on top of you and move on and these things happen. People experience a loss and it can be profound and they can carry that always. And so I think there's something very important about understanding that how vulnerable people can be in that place.
Is there any way, when I talk to a Hindu, and it's easy to say this, of course, in theory, but when I spoke to a Hindu and a Buddhist, I got the impression that they're not, if we can use these words, obsessed with death. They're not that afraid of it. Can you teach awareness of death or acceptance of death? question.
Well, I suppose death is a part of our lives. Death is part of every living creature, even expanding it to say to the plants and to and we say the animal kingdom. Death is part of the life cycle. It's probably culturally, it's a question about culture as well, I think, and maybe that's what you say about people who come from perhaps a non-Christian background. Maybe a little bit more ease with it than us people who are, we say, from the Christian background or the Christian faith.
Can I get over the death of a child? Can somebody get over the death of a child?
Well, I can only speak from our experience here, working with many, many families over the years, and I suppose what I would say to that question would be, I think parents, I believe, don't really get over formally like the death of a child. I can't say it's a cliche that obviously time's a good healer, but certainly with sort of time and their own growth and learning and understanding and experience, and I think the child is with them perhaps in a different place, or is in their lives perhaps continuously but not present. But I suppose I don't think it, like a parent will ever get over, like we said, the death of a child, because it's kind of maybe unnatural, really, you know, in the natural order of things. But I think there is a certain amount of repositioning a child, perhaps in the life of a family, that kind of child will continue to live, maybe kind of spiritually, in the lives of their parents.
Is there a part of society, or is there a part of people which at some stage will lead them to want to fight death?
I think we're seeing that manifest in some really interesting ways. In our own lives, in the media, you see it in this fascination with diet, for instance. The kind of underlying implication being that if you get the diet right, on some level, you'll live longer or maybe cheat death. I think there's nearly that assumption under there. There's an undercurrent of that. But people, you referred earlier to Buddhism. There is an idea in Buddhism, as there is in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, that underlying much of our tension or our anxiety that we carry with us is this fear of death, that it's bubbling underneath anyway. And I think whether it's through diet or exercise or other, I think, yeah, there are many of our behaviours that are driven by that and our wish to be able to avoid that.
And that was Dr. McKiernan ending the contribution of the Laura Lane House. We now move on to the Muslim tradition. To enlighten us further on same, Kayla Jackson speaks to Yahya Hussein from the Islamic Foundation of Ireland. To give us a brief background, Kayla asks Yahya to define Islam itself.
Yahya, could you explain to our listeners on this programme, Let's Talk About Death and Bereavement, exactly what the word Islam means?
Islam is an Arabic word which means peace and submission. And submission to the will of God is all what Islam is about.
Is it a religion or is it a way of life?
It is a way of life. It is not a religion in the sense that it is only a relation between man or human beings and God. It is more than that. It's a complete way of life, including the relationship with God, with human being, with the world around.
Now, Yahya, at the time of death, if you are a Muslim, what brings comfort to people at this time?
According to Islamic tradition, the dying person should be prompted in a gentle way, in a way that he is not like bothered or disturbed. He or she is prompted to say or to affirm belief in God by saying La ilaha illallah, or there is no God but Allah, there is no God but God.
What tradition do Muslims follow at this particular time when the person has been made as comfortable as possible at this last time of their life?
If death is then the dying person, you know, should be, the eyes of the dying person should be closed, his mouth also, you know, the two jaws brought together.
Yes.
And he's laid to in a comfortable way, and then after that the body is covered with a sheet, you know.
And is it cremation or burial?
It's always burial, there's no cremation.
So for a Muslim, at the time of death and at the time of passing, do they believe that their death is in relation to the if they lived a good life?
One cannot make a conclusion of the death of a person, that he was good or bad or a thing like that.
Yeah. Personally, yourself, how do you see, is there such a thing in Muslim life as a good death as opposed to a bad death?
The most important thing is that when a person dies, he or she should be doing the right things, you know, before one's death. So this could be called a good death. Yes, there could be something like a good death. But if a person was engaged in something evil or bad, and then he dies or she dies, then of course that's not good. The important thing is for a person to live a good, in a good way, righteous way.
It has been said that of all religions, Islam provides the most graphic details of what comes after death and lies beyond. Islamic doctrine holds that human existence continues after the death of the human body in the form of spiritual and physical resurrection. And Yahya Hussein mentioned this several times. There is a direct relationship between your conduct on earth and the life beyond. The afterlife will be one of rewards and punishments, which is commensurate with earthly conduct. It's very difficult to conclude a programme like this, but in an effort to do justice to the title, we have kept a small portion of the interview carried out in the Laura Lynn house for last. This is an exchange between Carmel Fitzpatrick and Dr. Aidan McKiernan.
I think that can be a thing with all bereavement, that you put it away in a different place, but there is always a part of your heart that's sore.
Yes.
And you can put it away for longer and longer periods of time. But then there are times when you take out this person and you look and you have the pain and you have the sorrow, and then you can put them away for a little while again. But you can never permanently put someone you've lost and loved away fully.
What you're articulating there very nicely is consistent with our understanding, with our theories of grieving and what happens and what kicks into place when people experience a loss. And our most recent thoughts on this, and these ideas do have an evidence base now, are that people will move between that intense focus on the loss, understanding what the implications of that are for their everyday, between that bit, and then in a sense, and I don't want to sound flippant, but getting the show back on the road. And so over time that we see that focus does shift more towards growing and developing a life again. And I think there's no, in a sense, maybe families don't get over the loss of a child, and I think probably they don't want it. They certainly don't want to forget, and there's never really any risk of them forgetting.
You have been listening to a programme called Let's Talk About Death and Bereavement. This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. The programme was co-produced and presented by Jerry Cunahan, Carmel Fitzpatrick and Kayla Jackson. Sound supervision was by Heather McLeod.